We're talking about the 2020 Democratic National Convention and Milwaukee's bid to be the host city for that convention. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The announcement could come any day now. The DNC's chairman, Tom Perez, is expected to select a city soon to accommodate tens of thousands of visitors who will converge on the convention city. What do you think about Milwaukee's chances of landing this event? What do you see as the pros and the cons of Milwaukee as a host city? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you.
So Milwaukee is one of three finalists competing to host the 2020 convention. Can you remind us who Milwaukee is up against?
Houston and Miami Beach. Miami Beach hosted the both parties' conventions in 1972, I believe, and Houston hosted the Republican convention in 1996 and recently hosted a Super Bowl.
Well, that's quite a range of options, with Miami Beach having like 90,000 residents and Houston being the fourth largest city in the country. What do you make of the contrast between the three options?
Well, Miami Beach, you know, is really Miami proper, and there are some problems with having a convention on a barrier island like Miami Beach. I used to live there, and you know, you've got causeways, you've got all sorts of sort of potential issues with the layout, but it does have a lot of hotels, and it's used to big events. So I don't think there's many questions in the case of Miami about the logistics or just the capacity, I should say. Houston also, you know, one of the biggest cities in the country, huge capacity. Again, the political symbolism of all these states is very different. You know, Florida is absolutely a classic battleground, not a classic, but a huge battleground state that may be trending slightly away from Democrats. Texas is a state that Democrats have their eye on, even though it's been quite Republican. And so that would be kind of sending a different kind of statement. And, of course, Wisconsin is a state that got away from the Democrats in 2016, and they want desperately to win back.
Yeah, does the appeal of hosting the convention in a state with a lot of electoral votes like Texas or Florida put Wisconsin at a disadvantage?
I don't think so, because it's really not. I mean, nobody really thinks that you deliver a state by placing a convention there. I think it's more about sort of the message you're sending more broadly. And that's the argument for Milwaukee. I mean, Milwaukee's a blue-collar city and a blue-collar Midwestern state that, along with Michigan and Pennsylvania, the Democrats lost and to some degree ignored to their detriment in 2016. If they can win those three states back and nothing else on the map changes, they win the Electoral College. So I think Milwaukee and Wisconsin send that sort of broader message about you know, the Democrats, we're going to try to, you know, we're going to pay more attention to, like, blue-collar voters, to Midwestern voters. We're not just a party of the two coasts. And so it's not just Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes, which obviously aren't deliverable by a convention siting decision. It's just kind of the optics and the messaging of going to a certain part of the country and kind of what that says about the kinds of voters you're going to be competing for.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander with thoughts on the convention city. Rich, hi.
Good morning. I think Milwaukee would be the perfect city for a national convention, either Republican or Democratic. The one thing I think Milwaukee is sorely lacking in is an up-to-date mass transit system. During a convention, if you've ever been in a convention city, people move back and forth very, very quickly. They need to get to their accommodations. They need to meet with other people. And that can be done to a certain extent with private transit and with cabs and Uber and those sorts of things. But you really do need an up-to-date mass transit system, and largely because of the people in the Assembly and Senate in Wisconsin, along with the previous governor, we simply do not have anything other than that, I think it's called HOP or something, that downtown inner loop.
Well, Rich, let's pause there. And Craig, at the party's winter meeting, which took place last weekend, did party officials talk at all about mass transit?
Well, some of the DNC, I talk to DNC members, you know, every state has a bunch of people on the Democratic National Committee, and these are the people that were meeting in Washington that I spoke to last Friday. And yeah, some of them did bring it up, but it wasn't, you know, it's not as clear a negative for Milwaukee as the caller suggests, because first of all, the competition, I mean, Miami Beach, Houston, they don't have the greatest transit systems in the world. None of these cities has none of them has a metro or subway. They have buses. The argument for Milwaukee here is that it's a less congested city, so if you're talking about cars and buses and shuttles like that, it's easier to get around than in some of these other cities than Miami or Houston, which may be true. But yeah, I mean, that is a negative, but in comparative terms, it's not as big a negative as you might think, given the competition. I mean, they're not up against San Francisco, New York, Boston, or Washington.
We're talking about Milwaukee's bid to be the host city for the 2020 DNC convention. It's up against Miami Beach and Houston, and an announcement could come any day. Craig Gilbert is on the line to talk about Milwaukee's odds as a finalist. He's a political reporter and the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, generally for Democrats, what is the political appeal of having this convention in Milwaukee?
Well, again, it's kind of, I think it's, here's one sort of odd thing that I don't think is going to determine the decision, but I was surprised by how many people who were going to participate in the convention brought up the weather. People understand that Milwaukee has great weather in the summer compared to Houston and Miami Beach. And so for the people that are actually going, that's just, again, along with the logistics, that's one sort of consideration. The two things that can really kind of put a downer on the physical experience of going to a convention are weather and, you know, steamy, hot summertime humidity and high temperatures and logistics. Again, an issue with Milwaukee, but, you know, the idea that you're going to spend too much time getting from point A to point B and that some people are going to be stuck in far-flung hotels. But the optics, the politics, the kind of, you know, just sort of the vibe of going to Milwaukee is pretty popular, I think, with Democrats. Again, they have a positive image, I think, of Wisconsin and Milwaukee. They understand it's a state that they had considered sort of part of their electoral coalition and had been voting Democratic for president for a long time, lost it in 2016, partly through neglect, and want to, you know, absolutely need to win it back in 2020. And they're also, I think, it helps a lot that Democrats won all these statewide elections in Milwaukee in 2018. So there's a sense, A, there's a sense that, yeah, we can do this. The state is bouncing back. And B, it's no longer the state governed by Scott Walker, who's a national symbol not only for Republicans but for Democrats. And his name came up a few times in conversations I had with delegates. The fact that Scott Walker's not the governor and wouldn't be the host governor of the convention is a positive for some Democrats when it comes to citing a convention in Milwaukee.
So who ultimately gets the final say in which city is selected?
It's ultimately up to the chairman, the Democratic National Party chairman, Tom Perez, who, as it happens, is married to someone from Wauwatosa and has a daughter at the University of Wisconsin. So he has these interesting Wisconsin ties. There's a perception that all things being equal, he's kind of, you know, he'd love to choose Milwaukee, but again, he has to get buy-in from, he's got a committee within the DNC that advises him on this, so he kind of needs buy-in from those folks, and he obviously would like to get broader buy-in from the delegates as a whole. You know, people are going to be unhappy no matter which site he chooses.
We'll be watching. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Okay. Anytime.
Craig Gilbert is political reporter and the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Up next, predictive software helps police departments determine when and where a crime is most likely to happen. We'll talk about it on the morning show here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at predictive policing here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Predictive policing is this idea that you can input crime statistics into a machine learning system and it will produce a model that predicts crime. But how predictable is crime? We're going to look into that question for the rest of the hour. When we analyze data, we can do a lot with it. We pick up patterns from police reports that can paint a more complete picture. But is it accurate? You can join in at any point here, 800-642-1234. What is your experience with the police department in your community? Do you think it practices fair policing? What did they do well? What could they do to improve? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Rashida Richardson is Director of Policy Research at New York University's AI Now Institute. That's a research center focused on social implications of artificial intelligence. She's lead author of the forthcoming study called Dirty Data, Bad Predictions, How Civil Rights Violations Impact Police Data, Predictive Policing Systems, and Justice. It's slated to come out in the May edition of the NYU Law Review, and it's currently available on the Social Science Research Network. Rashida, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So as we have this conversation about predictive policing, what should we bear in mind about how you see the definition of it?
So there's two forms of predictive policing. One is what you described, and that's more, and that fits in the category of place-based predictive policing, where you use police data to try to find out when a crime may occur within a given time window. So it could be from 2 to 4 p.m. today in a certain geographic location of a city. And then you have person-based predictive policing, which tries to identify a person who may be a victim or a perpetrator of a crime, again, using police data to make those types of predictions.
So how does predictive policing software work? Where does the software come in? And what is it supposed to do to help police departments?
Yeah, so the software is usually purchased from third-party vendors. Some of the prominent companies are called PredPol, HunchLab. IBM creates a variety of predictive policing technologies. And then some are modified and developed in-house in police departments. But all of them rely on police data, primarily crime data and other data points related to crime incidents. And that data, usually they're using years and months of this data to train the system. And then the system starts to predict based on one of those two models that I described, either predicting people who may be a victim or perpetrator of a crime in a certain time period. And usually those time periods are a little bit longer than 2 hours in place-based, which is looking at specific time periods and locations.
Is there a type of software that these police departments are using across the country in ways that they're using the software pretty standard from one department to the next? Or are they using big data in remarkably different ways from location to location?
So that while they may be buying software sort of off the shelf in certain ways, like PredPol and HunchLab, those are types of software you purchase. Each of the implementations will vary because they're relying on local data. So predictive policing that may take place in Pennsylvania will look very different from that of New York City.
We're talking about predictive policing and using big data in law enforcement tactics. Rashida Richardson is with us for the conversation, and she directs policy research at the AI Now Institute at NYU. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in law enforcement for a long time? How has the use of predictive policing software and other technology changed the way you work? Do you think machine learning has changed policing positively or negatively? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Rashida, you're the lead author on this forthcoming study that will be in the NYU Law Review on predictive policing. What are the biggest takeaways from your research?
So in this research, we looked at 13 jurisdictions that have long histories of discriminatory and unlawful police practices. And we looked at the data generated by those police practices over periods of time. to see how it may influence its use in a predictive policing system. All of the jurisdictions that we reviewed did use predictive policing at some point, either through a pilot or are currently using. And in some cases, there are jurisdictions that are contemplating or developing a system. And in all but four of those cases, we found that the data generated during those times of unlawful and discriminatory police practices did in fact skew or influence the outcomes of the technology. And in the four jurisdictions where it was less conclusive, that was due to a variety of factors, either the lack of public available information on the actual system being used, or a lack of public policies around data sharing, where there may be a county and a city within the same jurisdiction where one is using predictive policing, but the other had the history of discriminatory and unlawful police practices. So it was just not enough public information to make a conclusive determination in those cases. But I think in all of the cases, in the point of the study is that it raises a lot of scrutiny for the use of these tools and the claims of their objectivity or ability to be used without perpetuating discrimination.
And when you use this term dirty data, do you mean that this is data coming from these police reports that have been made and police reports that have underlying discrimination in them?
Yes. So the term dirty data comes from the computer science field, which is dealing with sort of big data and cleaning those data sets. And it definitely applies here because in all of the jurisdictions, you had lengthy periods of discriminatory and unlawful practices. So that means corruption where there was planted evidence and people were falsely accused of crimes, to examples of long periods of stop, frisk, and arrest practices that were disproportionately targeted at certain communities, which would then result in those same communities being overrepresented in their data, which would result in a discriminatory outcome. And with both of those types of data, dirty data practices, these systems would then project or predict where crime may occur, but it's based on data that's not completely accurate. So it could be that crimes did not actually occur in a certain jurisdiction, and now that predictive policing technology is suggesting that they were simply because there were problems with the underlying data.
So based on your research, how is predictive policing supposed to work?
Predictive policing, I think, I should know, but I think the theory and why a lot of police departments are using it is because it can be a useful tool for jurisdictions that have resource limitations. So if you have a limited police force with a large or complicated geographic location where you need to disperse those officers, it can help sort of optimize or prioritize certain areas to send officers. But when these systems are not being audited or validated in any way, or the police departments using them are not scrutinizing the data that's being used by these systems, especially when there is evidence of unlawful or discriminatory policing, then you're just reproducing the same problems with the guise of objectivity.
Well, Brock from Madison called in to ask, what is the constitutionality of this software? What about probable cause for law enforcement to start investigating?
Well, usually the incidents that derive from the use of predictive policing is where you have beat cops going to a certain area. So it's not necessarily with the exception of the person-based predictive policing systems that I previously described. It's more just sending police to a certain area, which leaves a lot of discretion to the officers. And one of the concerns we highlight in the paper is that these systems sort of create a feedback loop. So if you're sending officers to a certain neighborhood, telling them that a system said a crime may occur, then it's more likely that that's what they're looking for, when in fact that may not be the case. And so there, I think the use of predictive policing raises a lot of constitutional questions, but the opacity by which these systems are used, because we don't know a lot about where and how these systems are used, make it difficult for those who may be negatively affected by their use or have their constitutional rights infringed in some way, the ability to challenge the use.
We're talking with Rashida Richardson about predictive policing. She directs policy research at New York University's AI Now Institute. Predictive policing uses machine learning to guide law enforcement decisions. It's when computers learn from experience encoded in the data. How do you see this use of data analytics impacting the criminal justice system? How do you see it impacting the neighborhood, the community where you live? We're at 800-642-1234. Perhaps you're a patrol officer or a crime analyst. How have you used predictive policing in your work? What are the benefits? What are the potential drawbacks? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update right here on the Ideas Network. Talking about big data in law enforcement here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Part of predictive policing is using these algorithms to try to prevent crime by knowing what areas to prioritize as a potential threat. And this kind of algorithmic policing is often considered controversial due to its potential to reinforce pre-existing biases in policing rather than remove them. But predictive policing opens up a big opportunity to incorporate technology that helps decision making across law enforcement, and that could lead to breakthroughs. So what do you think about using big data in law enforcement? Do you think AI has changed policing positively or negatively, and why? And if you're a current or former member of law enforcement, we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. New York University's Rashida Richardson stays with us. She directs policy research at the AI Now Institute. Rashida, how can police departments tell how biased their historical data is? Is there some kind of measure they can use to know how compromised the data they use to feed their predictive policing system?
Currently, I don't think there's enough infrastructure in existing police departments to do the kind of wholesale review that's necessary. Many of the jurisdictions that we covered in our research are required to look back at their historical data and actually do audits of the data as part of the consent decrees that were entered after a finding of discriminatory and unlawful police practices. So in those jurisdictions, there's at least a legal requirement, but in jurisdictions that don't have some type of settlement or consent decree requirements, I think it's too much of an effort for police departments to do on their own. So there's little incentive for police departments to do that type of review. And the vendors that sell these technologies, at least there's no evidence that they perform those types of reviews. So I think it's something that's definitely necessary. But what's going to be difficult is finding ways to require police departments to do it, despite the amount of resources that would be necessary.
And your study looked at several police departments across the country, including Milwaukee. We know that Milwaukee received a federal grant for predictive policing software. But other than that, there's really no public information about it. What have you concluded about the use of predictive policing in Milwaukee?
So Milwaukee was one of the four jurisdictions that I mentioned earlier where we had less conclusive results, and it's not because of a lack of, and it was due to a lack of information about the system being used. Milwaukee entered a consent decree last year, which was the result of a lawsuit that challenged unconstitutional stop and frisk practices based on race since 2008. And there also was a Department of Justice investigation, but there was no investigation report that was released, only a draft report, which also found racial disparities in traffic enforcement policies, as well as several notable cases of falsified police records. So there you have documented histories of dirty data, essentially. And then the county was actually granted federal dollars for predictive policing technology, but we don't know anything about it. The only public documentation about that federal grant is just from the federal government. So there's a little concern there, because if there aren't clear policies around data sharing between the county and city, you can still have a problem with the county's implementation of a predictive policing technology having skewed or error-filled results because of the city's long history of discriminatory and unlawful police practices. And in fact, in other jurisdictions where we saw that type of use, where there was neighboring use either from a county or a city within a jurisdiction, there were concerns about the use of the system and data sharing.
Well, Clint Calden couldn't stay with us, but is wondering, how does this impact the community and law enforcement relationships? Building trust is very important. Does this help or erode at that trust?
I would guess that it does not help. One argument we make later in the paper after covering a few case studies is about the confirmation feedback loop. And that's, and the theory there is that the dirty data problem is not exclusively to police problems, but it affects society at large. So the act of seeing police departments engage in discriminatory practices or even being directed to certain neighborhoods that have historically been over-policed not only affects the police practices, but it can reinforce implicit bias amongst those in that community or neighboring communities as thinking that those over-policed communities have greater levels of criminalization compared to neighboring areas, which may not in fact be true. And the problem there that we use research to show is then that can also affect 311 and 911 calls, because what could be innocuous non-criminal behavior could be seen as something worth calling the police over, especially if you harbor any type of racial animus or bias towards a certain group that you're noticing something for. So it definitely has a societal impact, and I don't think that it only can have a negative impact on community police relationships, but it can also have a negative impact on the communities that are being policed and how you relate to your neighbor.
Well, speaking of 911 and 311 data, if these police reports have shortcomings in what is being recorded in them, what about using other types of data like 311 or 911 data?
Well, that's been the problem, is that I think a lot of the more prominent predictive policing companies have suggested that, okay, we won't use arrest data or even a drug arrest data because there's been demonstrated research that there's racial bias in those records. But then they have turned to 311 and other call for service data with the thought that that data is objective. And what we're finding out, especially in neighborhoods that are experiencing gentrification or some type of shift in the demographics, is that there's not only an increase in 311 and calls for services where there's been an influx of more white and affluent residents into historically lower income communities of color, but also that in those cases where there's an increase in 311 calls, that the outcomes of a citation or arrest increase three times. So there's definitely bias baked into that data as well. And it's not to say that you can't use other data sources. I think the argument we're making is that you have to scrutinize all the data, because not all data is objective as claimed.
Talking with Rashida Richardson, Director of Policy Research at the AI Now Institute at New York University, and taking a look at predictive policing. So, Rashida, what if you look at machine learning and not use historical data? Is there a way to do predictive policing by doing perhaps fresh data and allowing the machine learning to kind of learn itself based on future and current practices?
I think that there is a way to use predictive policing in the future that could actually benefit public safety, but as currently constituted, I don't think we have clean enough data sources. Like, even now, in most of the jurisdictions that we researched, it's not as if once they entered a consent decree or once there was a finding of discriminatory and unlawful practices, the whole police force just changed their behavior the next day. In fact, in some of the jurisdictions we studied, the consent decrees require sort of updated reports or audits of police records. And in some of those jurisdictions, they found that the discriminatory practices have continued. So I don't think we're in a place where use of police data or government data in general for predictive analytics is good enough. And I think there needs to be more work done on both the government side and by predictive policing vendors to validate and really scrutinize these data sources before putting these technologies into public use.
Yeah, are these vendors overpromising, and do they reveal enough of their trade secrets to know exactly whether they are able to deliver on what they promise?
I think the vendors are playing into the politics that are policing, and that anyone in an elected position wants to tote that crime is down or that their city, town is more safe. And so I think in general, policing has that problem where it's working against political and social influences that want crime to be seen as down. And that's why I think all police technologies, I don't think our critique is limited to predictive policing, but it also applies to CompStat, which is a data computer software that's used by most police departments. And even there, you see a lot of the same misuse issues. So I think there just needs to be a wholesale change in the politics around policing in order for these technologies not to reproduce a lot of the same problems. But regarding the trade secrecy issue, there is a lot of transparency issues around the use of these technologies. Even now, I probably can't even give you a headcount of how many jurisdictions in the United States use predictive policing because there's not a lot of public information available about these tools. And then a lot of the information that we do know has come from freedom of information litigation, not even the request, but months, years, efforts to get this information. And as in the case of Milwaukee, even sometimes searching, you can't find all of the information about these systems. So there's still a lot of transparency work that needs to be done in this area.
Rashida, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rashida Richardson is Director of Policy Research at the AI Now Institute at New York University. That's a research center focusing on the social implications of artificial intelligence. She's lead author on the forthcoming study, Dirty Data, Bad Predictions, How Civil Rights Violations Impact Police Data, Predictive Policing Systems, and Justice, which will come out in the May edition of the NYU Law Review. Coming up, we hear how the La Crosse Police Department is using predictive policing in its community, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How is predictive policing working in your law enforcement department? We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at predictive policing in action and how police departments are using technology to be more efficient. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cities across the country and here in Wisconsin are using data analytics to forecast, to prevent, to investigate criminal activity. The new crime analyst at the La Crosse Police Department is using software and looking for patterns in police reports to solve crimes and help patrol officers on the job. Where do you see data mining opportunities and pitfalls? We're at 800-642-1234. Jason Melby is the captain of police at the City of La Crosse Police Department. Captain Melby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Kate.
So does the City of La Crosse Police Department currently use predictive policing software?
We currently do not have a predictive program in place. We are going to be doing a two-month pilot with our vendor here in the near future. We just recently added a crime analyst at the La Crosse Police Department. So one aspect of that is to see if there is a predictive software out there that we think can fit into our police practices here.
As you've added this position as a crime analyst on the job at the police department, what does that job entail and how is that looking into data?
Well, our crime analyst is going to be involved in several aspects. One of them is going to be to help our officers, frontline officers, be more aware of the historical data that we do have and identifying trends through that data and feeding the information to our patrol officers so they're more aware of locations and times of particular crimes.
And so as you bring on a new software system that you're looking to put into place, can you give us a few examples how you might want to use it?
Well, there's a lot of things that anecdotally a lot of street cops know from just working the streets over the years. But by using this information and data, we can identify more specifically some patterns, dates, times, days of the week that things are going to be happening. For example, the City of La Crosse has a university, the UW-La Crosse, and when the college students go home during Christmas break, anecdotally, I can tell you that when they return, we have experienced an elevated number of burglary reports while they were gone during their Christmas break. This type of analytics may help us pinpoint a little better locations and patterns associated with those type of burglaries so that when we go to disperse our resources, have our officers patrolling the neighborhoods, they'll be more informed and maybe have a better idea of what the pattern is associated with those burglaries.
What about at intersections to determine accident rates? Would you use the software in that format?
Absolutely. An agency like La Crosse is obviously significantly smaller than something like Milwaukee or your Chicago, New York, for example. And some of the areas that we'd be using our predictive analytics would be to better address injury accidents, intersections that have got a history of producing severe accidents, and then increasing our proactive patrols in the area, our presence in the area. And, you know, the other thing that this can help us do is put out more preventative messaging and become more prepared to go to meetings with, like, the traffic engineer and address issues with maybe the actual intersection design.
We're talking with Police Captain Jason Melby of the City of La Crosse Police Department looking at predictive analytics and software that they will be introducing at their police department. So, Captain Melby, you're doing this trial run with predictive software. How are you hoping the software can enhance the work you do? What do you hope to see as the breakthroughs?
Well, you know, obviously you go to move ahead with technology that's available out there, and you're never quite sure how it's all going to work out. So that's why we're going to look at doing a two-month trial, and we'll see if it is actually going to be something that fits in with our style of policing in La Crosse and if it's something that we deem useful.
And so in this trial run, what will you be watching for and what would make you decide to keep the software?
Well, it would, I guess, that's a really good question of what a sign of the successful software is going to be. As the information is moved forward through the system and we get a chance at the administrative level to look at what type of reports and information that's moving forward towards us, we'll have to evaluate it at that time.
And so we just had a conversation about the risks predictive software poses when it comes to reinforcing biases that are already present in police data, police reports. We talked about dirty data. As La Crosse tests out this new software, how do you address these issues?
Well, obviously, first and foremost, for any police department, as they move ahead with a new approach in policing, is it's an addition to their police approach as a totality. Now, there's no substitute for good community policing, good community relations, good police reports, and professional practice in the field. So as we move forward with this and look at it, it's going to be part of a total approach and how we police our community.
So you see it as kind of one tool in the toolbox as you look at your whole department and what it can do.
Exactly. It's going to be a small portion of our overall approach.
Will you be using historical data, though, that the department has collected in the past?
Sure, and that's exactly how predictive policing is it's going to use the historical data to help predict into the future. And I just listened to the professor speaking on their analysis and their study that they did on predictive policing, and not going to debate her results. But obviously there's some level of assumption that there's already some dirty data in your data set automatically based on her premise of the analysis of the information. So I don't know what to say in regards to that.
How does this use of predictive software differ in a smaller community like La Crosse versus a Milwaukee?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. The city of La Crosse, if we're going to be using this predictive analytics, is going to be looking more at property type crime. City of La Crosse is not a location where we have a lot of shootings, for example, or a lot of armed robberies. So to use a predictive analytics to identify something that may only occur a dozen times in our community would be very difficult. However, we do have a significant amount of vehicle entries and home burglaries and those type of crimes. So when you go to use that type of information for these types of crimes, it's going to be a little bit different.
Looking for patterns is really important. And now that you have a crime analyst on the job looking for various patterns, is that helpful to your patrols in the field?
Well, yeah, obviously for the field officers, if they know that we've got a pattern of burglaries that are occurring at a particular time of the day, we can elevate our presence in that neighborhood. Additionally, we can do some preventive messaging to that neighborhood, and we can engage in some community policing by notifying the neighborhood associations from that area of what our predictive analytics is telling us and what our analysts is telling us for the patterns.
As we start to wrap up, Captain Melby, do you see this as the first step toward bringing in more technology to the law enforcement system with predictive analytics? Is this the introduction of something bigger?
You know, I'm not positive if this is an introduction to something bigger. Obviously, there's been larger agencies throughout the country that have used this type of data for some time, used this type of technology for some time. For an agency like La Crosse to have it introduced at this particular point in time, is going to be something that'll be new, and we'll see how it fits in. Obviously, the technology is always advancing. We've seen large leaps and bounds in the area of video, for example, where it's an expectation where many of the departments are wearing body cameras simply because the technology had advanced at such a rate that it's become common use. And I don't know if you'll see predictive analytics get to that point, where the software is available and it's more affordable to agencies across the board, that you'll see smaller and smaller agencies across the country or throughout the state taking advantage of that type of software.
Captain Melby, thank you for your time.
Sure thing. Have a great day.
Jason Melby is the captain of police at the City of La Crosse Police Department. Just ahead, doctors have alarmingly low job satisfaction, and our guest says that poses health risks. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.